This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast for Monday, April 11th, 2016. Welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host, Podcast Steve on Twitter. In this program, we talk to people in the public relations, communications, and journalism fields about their activities. And we also present interesting seminar panels and conferences being conducted around the country. In this program, a Meet the Media panel recorded April 5th, 2016 at Rutgers University in Piscataway, New Jersey, sponsored by the New Jersey chapter of the Public Relations Society of America, the Rutgers University chapter of the Public Relations Student Society of America, and the New Jersey chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Our firm's been hired by the PRSA New Jersey chapter to produce a series of short videos promoting the various programs and activities of the chapter. You'll be able to see those throughout the year at the PRSA New Jersey website, which is prsanj.org. Introducing the panelists and moderating the discussion is Ken Hunter, APR. He's the president and chief strategist of The Power Station, a communications agency based in Hillsborough, New Jersey.
And I'll start down at the very end. First, Josh Cornfield. He's the New Jersey news editor for Associated Press and based down in Trenton. Next to him, Tom Bergeron, who's the editor of NJ Biz. Next to him, Hema De La Eris. She is the consumer producer for the show Atulado on Univision, Channel 41 in New York. She describes that segment as news you can use, and you know, it's similar to Channel or 7 on Your Side, to give you an idea of her program as well. Next to her is Walt Kane, who also covers a similar beat. He's investigative reporter for News 12, and I know Walt's been there since the rocks cooled. ever since News 12 turned on the lights in 1996. Walt runs the investigative unit. He has a full-time producer and photographer that works with him, and his investigations there in New Jersey and typically involve New Jersey issues or regional or national news that has a New Jersey impact. This is of note, he does workshops for reporters on investigative journalism as well and helps other News 12 reporters in their investigative pieces. And then lastly, who you had just heard from, David Levitt. He is the commercial real estate reporter for Bloomberg News. He's been at Bloomberg for 15 years. Before that, at the News Tribune, the Home News Tribune, and Harrison Scott Public Relations, which is a...
Harrison Scott Publications.
Publications, okay. Which is a publisher of real estate newsletters based in Hoboken. And what David primarily covers is the New York City commercial real estate market, occasionally something here in New Jersey. And also it covers the aftermath of the destruction of the World Trade Center and the rebuilding effort, which seems to never, ever end. So you probably have tons and tons of material. We had a last-second scratch, Vanessa O'Connell from the Wall Street Journal. She told me last night she has a breaking story that they're having to work on. And I know when I mentioned this to some of our other panelists, they immediately went to their phones to try to see what it was. And if they needed to hustle and get on it as well. So let's start first with one of the bigger media stories. Now, we realize that the election is not a specific beat for all of our panelists. However, their outlets are certainly impacted. So you may agree, Donald Trump seems to be the gift that keeps giving for press. The LexisNexis presidential campaign tracker showed he generated about 100,000 articles per day last week. That dwarfed the next closest candidate's volume, Bernie Sanders, at 11,000 articles per day. And that trend has seemed to have occurred through the entire month of March. How do you see that trend continuing through November? And maybe, Josh, I'll start with you on this question. Do you see it, the volume of coverage, continuing to be at that high rate, or might it be trending up even more than that or down? And if you can, pull the microphone close when you answer, please.
I think as we get closer, it's going to go even higher. It's the story that is the most important story of the moment for now, for the future, for this country. And it's a story that people care about. Some people care about it just for the more colorful comic aspects of it. But then a lot of people care about it because, like I said, it's the future of our country. It's deciding who the next leader is going to be. And I think the press has a responsibility of doing accountability work on who all of these candidates are, not just Donald Trump, but Donald Trump being the front runner on the Republican side is the one that I think most of that firepower goes towards.
Okay. Any other of the panelists like to take a shot at that? Do you see the trend still increasing and staying like that through November?
This story has absolutely nothing to do with NJBiz, and we don't write any stories on Donald Trump. That being said, for those in the room who are involved in PR, and there might be one or two, I would give it as a perfect example of here is a person or a client or a company who is available to the media, one, it's amazing to me how many people are not available, and two, actually has something to say. It's not a scripted material. So the reason why there's so much coverage of Donald Trump is because he's available all the time and he'll say something of interest. So it's always amazing to me where we'll go to companies and they won't want to make anyone available, and when they finally do, it's something that's completely scripted that nobody would be interested in. So if you're in PR and you're representing someone and you want them to get media coverage, here's a perfect example of someone who understands how media plays. He's on everywhere and he has something, I'll use the term interesting to say. It's something that's non-different from the basic bullet point scripts that nobody up here has any interest in hearing the bullet point scripts from any other candidates that you can hear. It's refreshing, it's unique, it's different. That's why he gets coverage.
Anybody else want that?
Well, go ahead, Dave. As a commercial real estate reporter who covers New York, some people in Bloomberg are under the mistaken impression that Donald Trump has something to do with real estate in New York, and I try to kind of correct them. obviously he. He was born into real estate. He started out in real estate. He still has a couple of very high-profile properties, the Trump Tower and 40 Wall Street, to name them. But, for pretty much the last 20 years or so, his basic business has been to sell his brand. For the most part, just about anything new that has come along that has a Trump name on it is named that such because he sold the right to call it a Trump building to the developer, and the developer is actually somebody else. I've had kind of more almost nothing to do with the coverage of him and his race, though. Just in the past couple of weeks, we've been working on something, having to do with him and his real estate, the real estate that he has. But it's kind of gone into the larger effort to cover the campaign and to cover him in particular.
I think the one thing I would add about Trump is his candidacy seems to violate a lot of the basic rules of coverage and public opinion, and it's really fascinating from a PR standpoint, I think. This is a guy who has, on several occasions, advocated both sides of an issue. He says one thing, then he comes back and he says something else. He disavows, then he reavows, then he disavows again. Normally, when you do that, people remember the worst thing that you said. If you said something that is potentially offensive to one group, and then you disavow it later, they remember the bad comment. What's fascinating with Trump is how his supporters only seem to hear the part that they want to hear, and they just ignore the rest. I wouldn't advise that as a PR strategy for anybody else. I've never seen it work for anybody else, but so far it's working for Trump.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about an issue that seems to, you know, keep growing every single year, and that deals with the perceived bias of coverage. And this is our last presidential question before we move on into some of the others, which I'm sure this is something you're continually having to fight, to monitor, to just be aware of, to deal with reader comments. It's probably a significant issue. But the LexisNexis presidential campaign tracker also measures sentiment of the articles about the candidates by political party. The tracker reported last week that of all the articles about Democrat candidates, 8.6% of those articles have negative sentiment, yet for Republicans it goes up to 14%. Positive article sentiment for Democrat candidates was measured at 15% to 10.3% for Republican candidates. So knowing all this heightened awareness and, you know, a lot of divisiveness that occurs on in the media, both sides, what do your organizations do to, you know, I guess, try to ensure that your coverage is indeed balanced? Are there conversations that go on internally? I know with some of the editors that are having to deal with this, they probably need to really keep their antenna up to see, is this something that, boy, we need to go and get a little bit different of an opinion on this. How do you handle those sorts of things within your organization?
We definitely have a policy of being as objective and as fair as humanly possible. That's obviously the goal, to be fair and even-handed in coverage. There are some media out there that are definitely right-wing media and left-wing media, and that's been a phenomenon that we've seen in the last 15 or 20 years that I'm not sure is a good thing for those of us at news organizations that don't advocate, because I think a lot of people now think that everybody advocates. But yeah, we do make it a point to try to get both sides of a story told, to make sure the story is told in an even-handed way. The one thing I would say, though, and that this is almost antithetical to what I just said, but I'm not sure that necessarily telling both sides is the ultimate goal in journalism as much as it is to report the truth. So if you have a situation, this is something I run into with investigative reporting all the time, if I have one side that's telling me something that seems to be supported by at least some facts and the other side is just flat lying, I don't think it benefits the public for me to report both sides equally as if they have equal weight, because they don't. You have to report, this guy is saying this, but in fact it's not true.
So I would add in that the present day media, for a lot of people that are joining the media, feel like it's their responsibility to have picked a side. And you need to separate whether you're being a journalist or whether you're being a spokesman for a certain side. And so much of the media with the cable TV, that you literally can decide which side they're going to be on. And I've always thought it would be a good bit. It's almost a Saturday Night Live bit. When you come on and you have the panel of guests where a buddy of mine works for Fox News, and I say, okay, Brian, let me come on. You're going to introduce a segment and you're going to tell me who the three guests are. And I'm going to tell you ahead of time what they're going to say. And I bet 90% of the time I can predict what they say. Those aren't journalists. Those are commentators. So that's one issue you have to do it. One point Walt made there that I think is very good as far as equal coverage and equal sides. Obviously, you want to have balanced reporting in the sense where you're chasing the truth, but there also needs to be an understanding of, in journalism, in stories, stories are continuing. So we have an issue right now at NJBiz. I know everyone here has been following the Horizon Omnia healthcare plan to a great extent. It's actually very big news for a lot of people. So in assessment, you have the biggest insurer in New Jersey has introduced a new healthcare plan. Some people feel they're in, some people feel they're out, some people feel it's very controversial. Rewrite a story about Omni and Horizon almost every day. There was another legislative hearing about it yesterday. So one issue that you have to realize in journalism is some things are incremental stages in a story. So something might come out where somebody might have a comment or propose legislation or make a statement. Every time you do that, you don't have to go back and say, here are the 17 previous points by both sides to say why this is good and why this isn't good. Sometimes they are incremental updates to a story, as opposed to a huge, big picture, what we used to call a Sunday takeout, where it might be a little bit more coverage of both sides. Sometimes somebody will say something, and that will be the news, and the next story will be someone reacting to it if you can't get to it right away. So that's an issue as far as fair and balanced to understand, are we doing an incremental update to a story, or are we doing a one-time version of a story? And that'll be different. But Walt's point is excellent. The number one goal is to be truthful, and just because someone says, here's my side, if there's no validity to it or no facts to it, that's fine. And I will say for those of you in the room who are doing PR, understand that you are representing a client and a side. I get that. But you're also representing yourself. So if you're going to come to me about a story and you're going to pitch something that clearly is not factual, but it's what your side wants to do, understand by doing that, you're telling me this is not someone who's going to give me factual information. So you damage your own credibility by, quote unquote, supporting your side. So it's very clear, even when you're representing someone, to be honest about what you're representing, not just, here, we're going to go out and say that. And that goes back to my original point where you could go on any newscast, whether it's CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, and say, we're going to discuss this bill. And, okay, well, I'm going to hire this person because I know that they're going to give me this side. Well, when I watch that, they have zero credibility because I know what they're going to say. And they're not saying it based on truth and facts. They're saying it on who you represent. So understand when you're approaching the media as a member of a PR firm, someone who is representing a client, if you're telling me something that I know isn't true, but your client wants it to be out there because it helps your client, you've lost all your credibility with me.
I'll continue on from that. I think a lot of times we get press releases where someone says, this is the first time this has happened anywhere. This is the biggest. This is the largest. If you make a statement like that, I'm automatically going to be suspicious. I'm going to really start digging at that idea. And if it's not true, or if you can't prove the backup material that it's true, that your spin is correct, I'm probably not going to look at your next press release. So I think that's something important to keep in mind.
We're not dumb.
Some of us are.
Right. So this one I'd like Hema to take first shot at. What are some of the key changes in journalism that you see that are impacting your coverage now? We've heard in the past print reporters are now having to go and video their events. There's a social media aspect of as soon as you've covered something, get it out. What sorts of changes have you been seeing in the newsroom?
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, a shortage of resources is, I think, affecting everybody. And you can see it in, you know, having to shoot or edit. Luckily, that doesn't happen at our station yet. But it's also time constrained. You need to get the news. You need to check everything and make sure you put it out as fast as possible. So it becomes a challenge with, for example, investigative pieces where you really need to check your facts and make sure what you're saying is correct. You know, time really is of the essence. And then another issue that I think it's important. People have shorter attention spans now. You want everything in like a minute or, you know, 140 characters. And it's very difficult sometimes to take a story that is a complex story and, you know, just put it in 1 minute and get, you know, every side or make it a balanced story. So for me, those are, you know, some of the issues that, you know, I'm concerned with. But, you know, you just have to adjust and sort of adapt that. For example, I can't, you know, I can't do very complex investigative pieces every day. I have to maybe do one a week and then work on something that's a little bit simpler and easier so that we can have a quick turn and constantly be on the air. Because otherwise we'll probably disappear and they'll get rid of our unit. We no longer have the luxury of having units that are sitting there and working on stories for months without putting anything on the air. So, you know, that's something that you have to keep in mind too.
Yeah, I think Hema makes a lot of great points there. When we started the investigative unit in right around the beginning of 2002 at News 12 New Jersey. The news director at the time said to me, we'd like to see if you could put out a story a week on average. You know, it could be 2 1 week, one, you know, none in a given week. And at the time I thought, boy, that's a lot. You know, investigative stuff, it takes time. A piece a week, that's a lot. Well, in 06, that guy was gone, and somebody else came in and said, could you give us two a week? So we did, okay, we'll also throw in a quick turn consumer piece above and beyond what we already have. And then in 08, the news director I work for now said, you know, could you do three? It's like, three is really pushing it. I mean, I'll do what I can. And we did for a couple of years. And then to his credit, he actually spoke to me. This guy I still work for. He spoke to me in about 2010, 11 and said, you know what, three is too much. I can actually see the difference in the pieces that you're spending more time on. Why don't you back it off, try somewhere between two and three. And so, you know, we're at, as of the end of March, we're at 2.86 stories a week. It's something I track, and, you know, we're very diligent about that. So, yeah, I mean, to be able to do that, it's exactly what Hayman was talking about. We still do the piece that we spend a year on, but we're doing it around other things. We did some reporting on lead in drinking water, which was ironic because we were working on it before the whole thing started at the Newark schools, which is how we were able to suddenly drop this gigantic investigation almost simultaneous with it. And that took a few weeks of work. But then for every piece that's like that, yeah, you're looking at can you do a piece in half a day? Can we do a consumer, you know, related issue where I interview somebody on four different topics and we can parcel out four different consumer alerts based on that? And the other big change is definitely, as Ken said, it's social media. I mean, we've always had to write our own stuff, but, you know, we always write our own teases because of the potential legal issues that we run into with investigations. We write our own web stories, you know, and now we're also having to do social media, you know, Twitter, Facebook, so it's pretty much become a 24-hour-a-day job.
I think the big changes at Bloomberg have been not so much that, you know, we've just discovered, you know, that there is this thing called the web, and we're trying to figure out what it is. But I mean, it's always been there. But I think there is now an effort at Bloomberg to coordinate efforts better, to utilize our web portal better than we have, you know, ever before, and in a more sophisticated and more multifaceted way. If you're familiar with Bloomberg News, Bloomberg, we have. You know, the basic Bloomberg product is this dedicated professional computer software that is on the desks of every broker and trader on quote unquote Wall Street, which could actually be on any of the five continents, you know, so it has a news product as part of that, which is what I work for. But, you know, we also have BBR, the radio programming, and we have Bloomberg Television, and of course we have Bloomberg.com, the website. And in the last, you know, 5 years or so, we picked up Bloomberg Business Week, which used to be just Business Week. So we're represented across multiple platforms, and I think the effort now is to try to make them work as together as they can. We have kind of a dedicated team that writes purely for the website, and there's always a question of what do we write that goes on the web, and what do we write that goes in the Bloomberg that people are paying enormous sums for. So we're trying to work out that balance, but I think right now the effort is now to be more visual, to use charts and graphs more, anything that can provide a user or reader with just an instantaneous idea of what is going on that affects their business, that affects the economy, that affects, that really kind of gets beyond the surface and gets into where, you know, what these people really need and want. So
surprisingly, I'll take a slightly contrarian view. I started in this industry around the time a lot of you guys were born. And in that era, you had daily newspapers that were still very powerful. You had television stations and just some cable stations that were starting to become very powerful. Even the internet was just beginning and certainly isn't what it is now. So when I look at the media, and I'll take this from a PR and a journalism standpoint, the number one thing that is important is to understand who your audience is, what they want, and how they have it delivered. So I have a unique perspective. I started at the Star Ledger. I was actually the sports editor at the Star Ledger. In the Star Ledger, we said we were writing for 500,000 people. I then went to Yahoo, which some people may or may not realize is easily the largest media portal in the world. At the Yahoo and the Yahoo front page, the rule there was if you didn't get 1 million clicks in the first hour of a story going up, 1 million clicks in the first hour, then the story wasn't very good. So you needed to figure out how to have a story that was going to get 1 million clicks in the first hour. Kim Kardashian's name always got that. We always joked that you needed the water skiing squirrel because that would get 3 million clicks in the first hour. So now I work at NJBiz where we're writing for 50,000 people. And everybody wants their news delivered in a different time. So I will take it back to you guys and think about all of the different media outlets that you currently use. How are you getting your news, whether it's on the phone, whether it's on TV, whether it's on the internet, and what do you want from each source? You're expecting different things from different people. So understand what they're delivering. Some people, their goal is to give you as many quick hits as fast as possible, salacious stuff, this and that. That's fine. If that's what your goal is and that's what your audience is. But if that's not who you are, then don't be that. So at NJBiz, we write for C-suite executives around the state. These are really busy people. They spend their whole day working. They don't need to have information like that. I'm going to say it again. They don't need to have information like that. We get one shot with them, and it better be right, and it better be complete, and it better bring them something they know. And we know from our analytics that a lot of people don't view our – we could put a story up at 9:30 this morning, and people may not look at it at 9 till 9:30 at night because they've been working all day. So we got one shot at 9:30 at night to make sure that they have what they want. Other people are going to want – right away, okay, A-Rod's hurt, he's sitting out. I want to know that right now. And that's fine, and that's a one sentence. So understand who your market is and who you're writing for. So if you're representing, if you're pitching for PR and you have a story, understand who that media outlet, who they're appealing to and in what fashion and what they want that's going to be appealing for you. Don't have one PR pitch and say, I'm going to send it to everybody. And I love those PR pitches. I give them all the time. Here it is. Okay, well, that doesn't work for me. If you can't customize your pitch to me on how it's going to work, on who's going to be available or what detail, that doesn't do me any good. So you're going to have better success pitching if you understand what they're trying to bring to their viewer. Because some people are going to want it right away. Some people are going to want it in 140 characters. Some people are going to want it in 100 inches because they'll spend the time to do it. So understand who the media outlet is and how they communicate with their readers. And I think you'll see the successful media companies going forward are the ones that understand what a niche audience is. So I'll give one last example. I was a sports editor at the Star Ledger at a time when something we didn't know anything about started to take hold. How many people enjoy MMA or know what MMA is, right? Mixed martial arts. So the boxing guy comes to me and says, hey, I want to do a MMA column every other week. It's really big. This is really jumping. This was a long time ago. Nobody's heard of it. Trust me, this is really catching on. So we started an MMA column. We thought we were really great. We're the Star Ledger sports section. We're the biggest section in the state and this and that. And every other week, we gave somebody 15 inches on MMA. Meanwhile, there's an MMA website that was giving people 1,500 inches every single day. So why, after about 6 months, I said, why are we trying to compete in this pool? If you're an MMA fan, you're not coming to the Star Ledger every other Sunday to get 15 inches. You're getting stuff all the time. You're getting video. You're getting everything you want on your phone. You're getting on the internet. Why are we even playing in that game? So media companies that try to be everything to all people, as the Star Ledger tried to be, don't work anymore. You have to have a niche audience. Understand what your audience wants and deliver what they want, how they want it delivered.
Speaking of those press releases that get sent to everyone at the same time, the shotgun press releases, we can totally tell that that was sent to 6,000 people at once. And I know me, that gets deleted right away. So the AP is a little bit different. We are a B2B company, business to business, meaning that we have thousands of customers around the world. And they're all paying the AP to use that content. So we do have to think about audience, but that audience is scattered everywhere and just many different ways they're accessing the content. But what that forces us to do is really to think on two tracks every day. So we're trying to own breaking news. When there's a big breaking news story here in New Jersey, we want to get it out to the world. We want to make sure that we're sort of setting a higher bar and not chasing after every crime. And we're looking for the bigger stories that are going to resonate to a larger audience. So that's sort of half of my staff's job every day. And then the other half gets to focus on the bigger picture story, the higher value story, the story that's going to take an issue that's happening here in New Jersey, but tie it into something that's happening elsewhere. And that's a lot of fun. So doing those bigger picture stories, I think, have more value. They have larger audience tied to them. And that working on two different tracks every day makes the job a lot of fun.
Since we're talking about the press releases, definitely, you know, you should know your audience and know what that publication might cover. But one of the things I run into, for example, is people will send me just, you know, a news release that there is no way in the world that I would cover. I mean, I'm an investigative reporter, so you're telling me that your hospital has a new wing. I don't care. It's not the kind of story that I would cover. So if this happens a couple of times, I might politely, you know, point out, I run an investigative unit, these are the types of stories we're looking for. If I continue to get bombarded once a day from some PR firm with stories that I have no interest in, I'm going to just send them to junk. I'm just going to mark that this is spam, and any future stuff from them can go right into the junk mailbox because it's not of use. So you have to think in terms of not only is the audience that your publication is trying to reach, but if you're emailing a political reporter, there's no point in emailing about the opening of a new candy store. And if you're emailing me, first of all, emailing eight people, including me, is going to take seven of us out of the game. And it may take all eight of us out because the investigative people tend to look for stories that only we have.
I think this kind of gets to the kind of the bread and butter of what you guys are either already doing or will be doing if you're working for if you get a job with a PR agency. I think that the one takeaway, if you learn nothing else, is to really know the publications that you're trying to pitch for and understand what it is they publish and what it is they don't publish, because you don't want to be wasting your time, and you don't want to be wasting the person at the other end's time either. And you know, I don't know how many times I get pitches from people for they're opening up some they just bought some 30-unit building in Chelsea, and they think we're going to be all excited about it. But no. I mean, if you know what Bloomberg is writing about, we're writing about big issues, big buildings, big names, and you really have to kind of coordinate what you're pitching with what we're interested in. If you get onto what we want, then you're going to get a lot of results from that. But if you don't, it's going to be it's going to be pure waste of time. So the thing to do is just really read the publications that you're pitching to, know what they want, know what they don't want, and just take it from there.
So let me ask you a question. How many people here have been to a lecture or a class about your resume and your cover letter for applying for jobs? Right? At how many did they say you need to have one resume and one cover letter and send it to every single job you apply for? And you should never change it. You should have the same one every time. So why would you send the same press release to 10 different agencies? And how many people say when you apply for a job, you should find out who you're applying to? My name is not Sharon. The previous editor was Sharon. She hasn't been there for 3 years. I will get an email today to Sharon all the time. We can go on about press releases forever. I don't know how this started. The most important thing, I'll say this. I'll speak up. I get about 350 emails a day. So the most important thing on your press release, quite frankly, is going to be the slug line in your email. That's going to be really good. If you want to send me a press release with an attachment, I'm not going to open it. If you want to send me a press release where the actual news isn't until the second or third paragraph, I'm not going to read it. I don't need to hear that company A is the leading manufacturer of this and blah, 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 blah. And by the fourth graph, you tell me, hey, Tom, I got a really cool company. This is how they're changing manufacturing. They're using, blank, blank to do this. Okay, now I want to read it. But don't send it as an attachment. Don't send it as an email with a slug line. That makes no sense to me. Get right to the point. Get right to the point. But every single press release you send out should be different. Should be addressed to a different audience because we're all different, right? What Walt wants, what Josh wants, what I want, what David wants, what Eamon wants, they're all different. So tell me how your product appeals to me, and I might be interested. Again, you wouldn't send the same resume to everybody, and you would check who you were sending it to.
Going out tonight with a former editor who's retiring, and every time he got a phone call, his response was, I get 500 emails a day. Every day you would hear this from him at least 10 times, or maybe 500 times. So going beyond press releases, thinking about now I'm an editor, I have reporters who are hearing from folks in the field, and I try to let them do that as much as possible. But when I was a reporter, I think the best work I did with folks who worked in PR was those one-on-one relationships. I got to know the folks who I worked with every day, and, we went out for coffee, we went out for lunch, and we really developed that relationship. It was transactional sometimes. We weren't exactly friends, but we had a friendly working relationship, and I knew I could go to those folks when I needed something, and they knew they could pitch me on something, and I would at least listen. And if it was something that I cared about, I would think about doing something. So press releases, sometimes you got to do them. You get a lot of really good information in there, but if you can build that one-on-one relationship with someone, that's really valuable. And obviously, it's the same if you want to be a reporter. Building those one-on-one relationships with sources is just so key.
Well, in staying on that topic for a second, when it comes to building those one-on-one relationships, you get hundreds of emails a day, dozens of phone calls. You don't have time to go out necessarily for that cup of coffee, lunch, grab a cocktail. How should PR people try to develop relationships with media that are very pressed for time? Hema?
Well, I think it all comes down to trust and building that, if you help me, I'm going to give you the time of day next time. If I call you for some information, I need to check on this. I get this especially with public relations or people who work for government agencies, and I may be calling them to check on a business and whether or not they have violations. And sometimes, and I understand, they're busy. So they'll say, oh, the information's on our website. Yeah, I understand, but I just want to make sure that, that I'm confirming that your website's updated. So if you just dismiss me or constantly give me we cannot comment of ongoing investigations, and then all of a sudden, 2 days later, you put out a press release saying that, you're suing that company I asked you about last week, that's really, a way to, sort of break that relationship and trust. So start building that. And as I think everybody was saying, know your audience. I get a lot of people approaching me about, oh, I have this great person, this interview. And I said, well, do they speak Spanish? Our Univision, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Univision, but we're Spanish language media. So if you don't have somebody who speaks Spanish or some sort of element that appeals to our audience, I'm not interested. So it's really, really important that you know your audience. So I think everybody's very busy, but you find the time to work on those relationships, especially with someone is willing to help, is knowledgeable on their subject. If you don't know, obviously you're going to start at a job and you may not know everything there is to about that specific field because you're just a public relations person. But ask, you have to go within your organization and ask and get that information. That's how you help journalists, by gathering information and providing us that.
I guess the one thing I would add to that is, I mean, to a certain extent in journalism, the PR people, the spokespeople, the media relations people are almost sort of a necessary evil. You know, I would rather speak to the people who actually make the decisions, or the people who are actually the subject matter experts in an organization. So if you can make one of those people available to me, then I know that you're somebody who I can do business with. I mean, 90% of the time what happens is I put a request out to you. I have to explain what the story is about. I have to, in detail, because you don't know this issue. Then you try to find somebody who can answer the question, and maybe you come back with an answer that's, very shallow compared to what we're working on. And that, that can be frustrating. So if you can make the subject matter expert available, even if you're on the line too, that can help a lot. One of the things that I find useful is because of the nature of what I do, you're probably not pitching investigative stuff very often, but if you have a client who would work for me, we did a story about hacking ransomware a few weeks back. I got a call from a PR person I know saying she represents a security expert, cybersecurity expert, 8 minutes from our building. Perfect. He's in the Rolodex now. I've actually interviewed him for a story last week because he's there. So that type of thing helps.
I'll go back to an original comment I made. We're not dumb. So if we ask for a comment and it takes 2 days and something comes back that's incredibly heavily scripted, we're not dumb. So you haven't helped us, and that's okay. Call us and say, hey, we can't comment on this, a good rule in the journalism rule is to tell it to mom journalism. Everyone heard the tell it to mom tale of journalism? If you go cover a water commission hearing, right? How many people want to go cover a water commission hearing, right? And you come home and your mom calls you and says, what'd you do tonight? I covered a water commission hearing. Well, what happened? Your next sentence, you're going to tell them what happened. Well, they decided that they're not going to build this pipe because they don't have enough money and they're not getting, the governor's all pissed off and blah, blah, blah. That's the real story. That's the tell it to mom. So tell it to mom. Well, the commission met and the assemblymen decided after, nobody wants to hear that. So do that. So if you can build that relationship where we're actually having honest conversations, then we'll keep having it. The one thing that we both have in the media and in PR, we both need relationships. If the media doesn't have relationships, we have nothing. Give me a reporter more than a writer. We need to have relationships to get information. And you guys, PR people, need to have relationships with the media. So we both need it. So let's have an honest relationship. And let's not pretend like, oh, well, in this case, all the rules are off and we're going to determine that, we're only going to do this. And what can you send me your questions in advance? No, I can't. And I can't. So if you want to start that way, then we don't really have a relationship and we're not dumb. So you can't really control that. Let's just have an honest tell-it-to-mom relationship where I can talk to you and you can talk to me. And if we do that, those are the people that we're going to return their calls and they're going to return all calls. So when something happens, if the minute your company gets fined or your CFO is charged for embezzlement, right, are you able to get the truth? One thing with the reporters that will say is, okay, so this story breaks, whatever it is, story A. Who are the five people that you can call that'll tell you what really happened there? And if you have those five people, then you're a reporter and you're going to get the information. So on the other side, if your company is accused of embezzling or doing something really awful, who are the five people that you can call and give them the honest truth about it? That's not the time when you need to reach out to the media and decide how we're going to spin this story. That relationship needs to have been built before. So have an honest relationship. You're not dumb. We're not dumb. Let's not pretend that we're dumb. It's just makes things go a lot faster.
Hoping not to sound repetitive, I'd say that some of the best relationships I have with sources are with public relations people, and some of the worst relationships that I have with sources are our public relations people. There's the stereotype of the dark side, as you probably know. I operate under the illusion sometimes that if your title is media relations specialist or something, that means that you are there to basically facilitate reporters to do the most honest and the most informative job of covering your company that they possibly can, and that they're in that you have a certain sympathy to the reporter and the job that he or she is trying to do. Too often, media relations means just putting out the, you'll excuse the expression, PR position of the company that you work for, and you know, we're not in the business of giving your company a free ad. You know, I have a few media relations people who call me up, will call me out of the blue and say, what are you working on? Is there anything that you're working on that I can help you with and get you an expert or somebody who can help enlighten you on a story that you're working on? And so they flatter me into thinking that it's my agenda that they care about, And those relationships I find are very useful to me. But when somebody is, you know, basically, you know, acting as like they're in charge of the bunker, you know, that's something that I'm not going to think kindly about them, and I'm not going to think kindly on the company that they represent.
So let me put it another way. I use another number term. Excuse me. If we have a relationship and you're in a PR, and you like everything that I write, right? 100%. That means, one, I'm not doing my job. It should be 50-50. You should not like half the stuff I write. And if you like 100% of what I write, that means my audience is not very informed and is not coming to my news source to get good information. So I'm a complete failure for your company if you like 100% of what I write. Because then I'm no longer a credible source, and my audience that you're trying to get the news to isn't going to come to me because I'm not credible. So the deal with Horizon and hospitals, right? Well, we know people on both sides. If Horizon likes everything that we write about the Omnia situation, we're not doing our job. If the hospitals like everything that we write, we're not doing our job. It's a 50-50 relationship. And when something happens and something goes wrong, if your company is fined $4.6 billion, you're probably not going to write the way we write it. And if we write it in a way that it's a positive spin on this $4.6 billion fine, then our readers aren't going to like us because we're not a trusted source.
Yeah, you know, Tom brings up a point that I was actually going to make something very similar to that. And I guess what I would add to it is some of the really close relationships I have with media relations people, with spokespeople, started out with that type of story. Let's face it, you don't usually want to get a call from me or my producer, because the nature of the reporting that we do, it's probably an investigation and it's probably one of your clients who's under investigation. But if we have that type of situation, and instead of trying to, you know, get into that bunker mentality and try to convince me that this is there's no story here, you know, I don't understand why you think this is a story. I mean, that's not a good place to start. I mean, we're probably going to do it. Now, if you can show me factually where the other side is misleading me, you know, I can kill a story at that point because I'm not going to put something on that's wrong. But if you can be, the big thing is if you can be responsive and you can give me an answer and you can give me an answer that's supported by facts, and you understand, it, you know, that in that type of situation, it's probably not going to be a story that your client is in love with, but it is what it is. Then, you know, we have that relationship going forward. I know you're a straight shooter. I know you're going to tell me what's real. You're not going to try to convince me that there's nothing to it. And there are certain people where, you know, there's one spokesperson for one government agency in Trenton who, you know, I won't mention him by name, but his first response to every inquiry we have ever given him is, I don't understand why you think that's a story. Well, okay. So that's not working. You know, let's get past that. We understand you don't think there's a story. Now, how about you respond? But if there's somebody I have a good relationship with and they say to me, you know what, I'm not sure why you're, I think you're barking up the wrong tree here. That might make me sit back and take another look at it.
We had a situation, I was at the Kansas City Star briefly in my career, and we were covering KU basketball, which if you guys know Kansas basketball, is a pretty big deal. So one of the star players in Kansas, it's the famous Moon Bar story that I know you guys were all following. This guy got in a bar fight with a local kid, and he got stabbed. And he got stabbed in the calf by the local kid. And, of course, Kansas wants to release that some guy jumped this guy because he was a Kansas basketball player. And, oh, by the way, he's a drug dealer because he had a possession charge, this and that. I mean, this was a really, really lousy bar in Topeka, Kansas, which is not which is Topeka, Kansas. So we actually did a lot of incredible reporting. If anybody knows Jason Whitlock, who's on TV a lot, he was a great reporter on this. And we found out that the Kansas player's stab wound in his calf was coming up, right? So he got stabbed in the calf from a knife wound going up. So the only way that can happen is if the guy who did the stabbing was on the ground fighting for his life. So the idea that this guy jumped the Kansas basketball player was not true. We then FOIA'd his, this is an unbelievable trick. Anybody, if you ever, if anyone is in jail, by the way, in most states, any telephone call you make in jail is public information. So we went and got the tapes of this guy's jailhouse conversation when he first got in, where, you know, his buddy or whoever came to pick up. This was a complete lowlife of an individual, but he was in a bar, and we got the phone call, and he's explaining, this is J.R. Giddens of KU. He's like, who's J.R. Giddens? This guy had no idea who this guy was, that he played for Kansas. All I know is somebody was disrespected during a pool game, and a fight broke out, and he was on the ground, and he knifed the guy. So the whole spin that Kansas was trying to come out for 2 weeks about this drug dealer jumping this Kansas basketball player wanted to go to notoriety was completely false, and we had great reporting on it, won some awards. It was fabulous. But here was the best part of the story. So the night before it goes out, we call the Kansas AD, who we had a good relationship with at 9 o'clock, and said, Lou, okay, we need to talk about the story. And his first response was, how bad is it? What do you got? We got this, we got this, and this. He goes, off the record. Okay, there's no way he's staying here. We got to do this. Da-da-da-da-da. I get it. He trusted us that we had done it right. We had that relationship. Okay, now we're going to go on the record, and we got the official KU athletic department that we're going to continue to investigate, by the way. And sure enough, the kid was gone. I mean, this was a bad kid. But the idea was we had a relationship with Kansas basketball, and we were the biggest media outlet in Kansas. And speaking of bias, if you were a Missouri fan, you assumed everything we did was pro-Kansas, and if you're a Kansas fan, pro-Missouri. And back and forth. But we had a relationship with the athletic director through enough conversations that in a bad situation, he knew this was bad. He knew this was a bad kid in the wrong part of time, the wrong part of town at the wrong time. And he trusted us enough to say, what do you got? And knew if we had it, we had it, which we did. So it wasn't an immediate spin. I don't know what you're talking about. This, he was purely, I mean, so on that front forward, he was very honest with us. So any story we had to do with Kansas athletics moving forward, you knew that if you called the guy, it might be off the record on background, which is very important, but you're going to get a straight shot because he's going to admit, yeah, we got a player who's in a knife fight in a bar and is not going to try to sugarcoat it. So to Walt's point, the next time he says, I don't know, that doesn't sound right to me, I'm going to trust him because he's going to admit it when he's wrong and he's going to admit it when he's right. So that type of relationship that you're building, that's what we want from people. And if you're a reporter out there, and I'm hoping there's a couple of reporters out there, that's the relationship you want to build with everybody that you're working with, to be able to make that phone call and have the guy say, what do you got, as opposed to fighting. That's a great relationship.
So we'll be shortly having a Q&A session for the panel as well, so get your questions ready. I'd also like to remind everybody, if you're posting on social media, it's at PRSANJ to tag on that. When it comes to trying to determine, when you're gathering news, trying to find story angles, what sort of a ratio do you see you typically use between asking your sources, PR people, which I'd also put press releases on that, and then other media or blog coverage, when you're trying to find what's, you know, important, the news of the day? Josh?
I think we start every day looking around what others have done and look quickly at what of those stories we need to catch up on, which we can let pass by. But for the most part, we try to drive our own coverage. You know, we're thinking every day, what are the five or six stories we need to care about today? And we're trying to come up with them enterprising stories on our own rather than being pitched on a press release. So that's our main goal every day. Throughout the day, we get various releases that we do write up. But for the most part, we try to aim higher. Not to say that the release isn't about something interesting, but we try to aim for a story that's going to have that larger audience that people aren't just talking about in New Jersey. So for the most part, we try to come up with the stories on our own. But then throughout the day, we mix in other things that are happening that you guys may let us know about.
I don't know that there's a formula for our business coverage, but I will say this. We'll certainly get stories, both be pitched to us, stories that we have conversations and find. But the best formula I can say is you can tell how good the reporter is based on the idea of how many stories he or she already has. And he has those from the relationships he has. He's constantly talking to people, whether it's media people, whether it's people in the industry, and this and that. So our healthcare reporter always has 15 stories that she's working on. Does that mean someone can't send a release that's a great healthcare story that I can say, hey, Angelia, this sounds really cool, let's look into it? Absolutely. But if you're a reporter that only has those stories, then you're just not a very good reporter. So you can get them. We can't know everything. We actually do want people to talk to us about things that are happening on. And we'll determine how good or bad they are. But the idea of a good reporter is they should always have 5, 10, 15 stories that they're thinking about, but we can always take new ideas.
I think for us, we're also looking for original content. We don't do too many stories based on a press release unless I do get from time to time a spokesperson who might have something and give me a little scoop and say, hey, you know, you should be looking at this. But most of, I would say 90% of our stories, and I'm talking about our consumer unit, our consumer / investigative unit, 90% of our stories come from our viewer tip line, which are sort of my eyes on the street and my ears on the street. And they're usually, you know, it's our audience calling us to complain about something, a problem or an issue or something they saw or they experienced, and they just want us to take a, you know, better look at it. So I would say 90% of our stories come from our tip line, and they're all original. I think when you're writing, I mean, if you're going into PR, I don't want to say, don't put all your efforts into writing this wonderful press release, because especially if it's like, oh, you know, can you do a story about this beautiful new gadget I have? Most likely you're not going to have a story because that's an advertisement, and you know, you're not going to get a freebie on that. Now, if you can find a way to tell me why, you know, that is going to change lives, or I don't know. I guess it depends on the story or product, but most likely, you know, just think about it in terms of a story. What elements are we going to need? So unless you can provide me with those elements and sort of a balanced story, we're probably not going to cover it.
Yeah, like him, we have our dedicated unit with the investigative unit, and we probably get 600 or so calls or emails or Facebook messages a week, of which, you know, we can do 3 on a typical week. I've always wondered, you know, what exactly the ratio is, and one of these days I'll look back at like the last 5 years worth of stories and try to remember where do they all come from, because I think it would be an interesting, you know, interesting to see the percentages. Obviously, a lot of them come from tips from the public, that type of thing. There's another tier that come from tips, but not just public tip line tips. Somebody I know, somebody who's been proven to be credible in the past. I mean, you know, there was a guy once who about 5 years ago told me that there were cops in Union City, you know, all the high-ranking guys had these no-show arrangements on this outside detail work. They were getting paid $65 an hour, and they weren't showing up, or they were showing up, you know, for 5 minutes and leaving. And when we investigated, he was absolutely right. When that guy calls me, I will take the call, you know. And then there are certain times, I think, we look at like with the lead investigation I told you, it was obviously it was out there in Flint, and we, you know, one of my managers asked, what do we know about, you know, New Jersey drinking water? I said, well, it's different. It's, you know, that was a contaminated source. You know, we don't have a contaminated source. I can tell you that to the extent that there's contamination, it's usually going to be from individual pipes. It's not going to be, this is, like I said, before, way before Newark, any of that stuff happened. It's usually individual pipes. It's not going to be the water supply. But then I thought about it, said, you know what? Maybe that right there is just a good jumping off point. You know, your water company gets tested and gets clean bill of health, but it doesn't mean the water in your house is any good. And, you know, maybe that's a good jumping off point for a piece. So I don't know where that came from. You know what I mean? That came from an internal discussion, and sometimes that winds up happening. So they come from all over the place. And, you know, I don't know what the ratio is, but definitely if you have something, you know, pitch it, and pitch it well, because you're trying to be one of the three out of 600.
I can say from the standpoint, we're decidedly not investigative reporters, though I think we all try to kind of keep in the back of our mind things that we want to think that do need investigating, and if we can, we will devote, you know, some amount of time to pursuing something that's a little bit more a little harder to dig out than the typical thing. But I'm totally agnostic on the subject of where a story comes from. You know, it can be, I think my job is to provide our readers with the best, freshest, most surprising, most provocative news that there is on the subject that I'm covering, New York commercial real estate. And I could, you know, obviously, you know, my metrics, the things that help to decide what my salary is going to be, are based on how much original material I produce, how many scoops, how much stuff that you can read on the Bloomberg, but and nowhere else is the premium that I shoot for on a daily basis. That said, if the publications that I compete with, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, Crane's New York Business, if they produce a story that has the elements of things that I'm looking for, I'm going to follow that story and try to come up with an angle that is unique to me, and advance that story and give the reader something that they didn't get from the other publication, even though it was broken by another piece of media. You know, the prime consideration is this something that is momentous and has that point, you know, is this the right moment for that story, and everything else fades. Now, some of that can be a really good public relations pitch. Some of that could be somebody from a PR department calling me up and saying, do you know what our company is doing? You know, you just did a story on blah, and we're doing blah plus. And I'm going to pay attention to that. So, you know, I think I know one time I was covering a merger, and it was a Sunday, and we knew there was going to be a press release very soon about what this company was doing. And I was like calling to try to beat the press release, because, you know, if we beat the Wall Street Journal by 5 minutes, that's a scoop, you know, that's where it works. So I'm calling like every hour. I'm calling the same people over and over again. My daughter, I'm sitting around the dining room table doing this, and my daughter, who's like 14 at the time, says, "Your job is to annoy people, isn't it?" And it kind of is, so, you know, but, you know, for the right cause, you know, I don't mind annoying people.
You know what, if I could just take 10, 15 seconds. One of the things that David said that I thought was great is the idea that we're agnostic as to where the information comes from. I think that's true for all of us. None of us care ultimately where the information originates, as long as it's accurate and it's important. So every now and then somebody will say, well, you know, that guy's crazy. Well, okay, but is this information accurate in this particular case? I don't care about his mental health. You know, if his information is accurate in this particular case, then it's a story. And the other one, this is my all-time favorite line. I still hear it a few times a year. You're talking to somebody who's a disgruntled employee. Well, yeah, of course I am. I mean, if he was happy, you wouldn't be talking to him.
Or they'd be pitching you the good smiley face story about something. We will now go and open it up for audience Q&A. And Steve has a microphone here. If you wouldn't mind waiting until he brings it by to go and state your question, since it is being podcast.
Hi. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to keep it to one. First, I just want to say I wish my clients were actually sitting here listening to what you have to say, because many times when we have to, you know, wait 24 to 48 hours to give you a statement or provide something that isn't 100% accurate or colored, it's, you know, a difficult dance that we often have to do between our relationship with you guys and what our clients want and expect from us. So we get it. We're not stupid either. Just letting you know that. The other thing, I was just interested because you're talking about how resources are limited and time is limited. And one of the things that we've tried to do over the past couple of decades is figure out how to present you guys with information that's going to be useful that you can sort of just pick up and pop in if that even ever happens. So I was just curious how open you are to receiving B-roll from us, or, you know, not something that's cut and edited, but just straight up. Or infographics or images, you know, when you talked about providing information in sort of a short snippet to address attention spans. So how open are you to that?
By definition of what you do is to present something that's not 100% factual, but is 100% beneficial to your client. So it would be difficult for us to take something that you do and just flick and plop. I mean, it would be great. You can make a cool little graphic, this and that. But we would not be doing our jobs if we do not say, okay, if you're going to tell me that 72% of the workers in the country between 35 and 40 are doing blank, we need to try to verify that or source that to you in some way. So to some extent, appreciate the idea of trying to be helpful in this and that. But the other extent, we have to look at it and say, okay, where are you coming from? If everything has to do to support your client, which is your role, and that's understandable, again, that would impact us. And if we were to ever take something like that where it clearly wasn't accurate and we got fooled, that would damage our credibility tremendously. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, absolutely. B-roll also, which is I was going to talk about video, is a tricky thing. We don't run video news releases. We will occasionally run third-party video. We always then super at where it's coming right from, because we don't have editorial control over it. You know, to the extent that, you know, if you're representing an automaker and you've got, you know, video of a car that's on a test track and, you know, beauty shots of it, sure, I'll use that. And I'll, you know, courtesy it, you know, Ford Motor Company. Again, Ford may not like the story in that particular case, but, you know, we're happy to do it. A lot of it really comes down to, is it organic and is it honest? And, you know, I mean, if you're giving me a video of your, you know, if it's a New Jersey company and it's got the manufacturing is overseas and you're giving me video of the actual manufacturing facility, yeah, why wouldn't I want to use that?
Right. We use photos, submitted photos all the time, again, on the assumption that, hey, here's a rendering of a building that's going up. Here is a nice grip and grin photo of two people that we hate to use, but we have nothing else. God bless. We'll take it, and it'll say courtesy of someone, and it's clearly, okay, these two companies have merged, and here's the two people shaking hands and looking at something and talking about how great everything is.
From a consumer story standpoint, sometimes we have covered certain news releases. Like, I can give you an example of, like, a profile that we did on a nonprofit organization, and there was a for-profit company behind it, but they were giving, I don't know, I think a discount to people that donated a coat. So we feature a woman who received a donated coat. I mean, the company did get a mention, but the story was not about the company, clearly. It was about the nonprofit, you know, collecting coats and giving it to the poor. So sometimes there's a way to sort of, you know, find an angle to a story and get your name out there, but not just do a story about my, you know, company.
So back to the subject of press releases. Press release follow-up, the phone calls, the voicemails. Is it helpful? Should we do it? Should we not do it as PR professionals?
I think it really comes down to the thinking about who your audience is and what my audience is. If it's something that you think that you truly think is really going to be valuable for the people we're writing for, then yeah, I don't mind that at all, because we do get so many, we do miss things. But if you're following up just because you sent it and not thinking that through, then I think you do more damage than help.
Yeah, I would agree with that, case by case. If you're pitching a an expert to us in coverage that we're currently doing and you want to follow up with a phone call, by all means, do that. If you have an event, it's a weekend event, there's a car wash for charity, there's a blood drive, whatever. Sure, put it out there. You can follow. And this is not really going to go to me. It's going to go to our news desk. But sure, send it out. You want to do a follow-up call to make sure that it was received. You can do that. But there is a point of diminishing returns. Doesn't matter how many phone calls you make. It's not going to affect whether it gets covered. So much of that is circumstantial. Especially it's, a lot of these, you'll say, are a Saturday morning story. Well, we have maybe four crews working. Now, if it's the fifth best story, it's probably not going to be covered unless it happens to be right near one of the fourth best stories, in which case we'll tell that crew, while you're there, could you run down the block and shoot this event? I think sometimes it's probably the best thing, if, for those of you who are in PR, the best thing to communicate to your client on that is, I would love to tell you that there is some sort of scientific story selection process, that the pitches come in and we have a meeting and eight people vote on it. We throw out the high and the low. And if the others average 7.75 on a scale of 1 to 10, well, then the story gets covered. But nobody does that. And a lot of it is what else is happening that day, and it's there is a certain amount of randomness to it.
Yeah, I think it boils down to kind of my earlier comment. Kind of the number one rule is to know who you're pitching to know the publication, to know the reporter, to know what his or her interests are. If it's something that and you feel it, deeper than just on the surface, that yes, this is something this guy is going to really want and need, then call him twice, call him three times, send a follow-up email. Sometimes I'm going to get releases, get so many releases and that I'm going to miss something, and I really appreciate if somebody calls me and says, by the way, did you see that release? We have this event coming up, blah, 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 and you really, this person and that person, and you really want to talk to them. Yeah, definitely follow up. But if the subject matter was nothing that we would be interested in the first place, then the release was a waste of time, and the phone calls are even doubling down on stupid. So don't do it. So
this is going to go back to the relationship. If you and I have a relationship, and you know what kind of stories I want, I've used your stories in the past, I don't mind. And I'll say this: I answer the phone. If I'm sitting at my desk and someone calls, I answer the phone every time. Now, the catch is, as is the case right now, I'm not at my desk all that time. And anybody who sent an email to me this morning, when I get back to the office, am I going to go back and look at the 100 emails that I missed? Maybe, maybe not. What's going to happen the minute I walk in the door? So the follow-up to the idea of, hey, I sent it once, did they see it, is good. But also the point they're making is we should have a relationship, and you should understand what I'm having to really pitch the stuff that that I want from past history, to say, hey, you didn't see this, but you really should be at this event, and this guy's speaking, or this woman is doing this or that. If we have that relationship and you totally understand what we're doing, then I don't mind getting a lot of calls and emails from you about a certain thing, because you're right, I do want to hear it. But
just quickly, I'm going from this event to having lunch with a source. Helped set up by a PR person, by the way. But by the time I hit the office this afternoon, it's going to be maybe 1:30 at the earliest, or two, more likely closer to 2. And pretty much an entire morning and a good chunk of the afternoon's emails are going to be piled up waiting for me to take a look. I'll look at some on the train going in, but you know, that's the easiest way for me to miss something is in a situation like that where my attention span is limited to begin with and is now you know, totally distracted by other stuff. So.
That's why the slug line is so important. Because right. you're scrolling. It better catch my eye.
Well, I mean, I could spend the rest of the afternoon going through emails. Right. But I'm probably not going to do that.
Okay, well, we've hit 10 o'clock, our allotted time. I'd like to invite, if anybody would like to come on up and talk with any of our panelists, you're welcome to. And again, I'd like to thank Josh Kornfield of AP, Tom Bergeron, New Jersey Biz, Hema De La Eris of Univision, Walt Kane of News 12, and David Levitt of Bloomberg. So let's please give them a round of applause. And thank you again, everybody, for coming.
And that will wrap things up for this edition of the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. Our thanks to the New Jersey chapter of the Public Relations Society of America, which allowed us to record this panel discussion. We're also producing some short videos for PRSA New Jersey. You'll be able to see those at prsanj.org over the course of this year. I'd also like to remind you about my book with Donna Papacosta from Toronto, Canada. It's called The Business of Podcasting, How to Take Your Podcasting Passion from the Personal to the Professional. It's available on the Amazon Kindle and in trade paperback. More information at thebusinessofpodcasting.com. We produce this program in the studios of Professional Podcasts. It's one of our own Lubetkin Media Companies, based here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We're on the web at beingthemedia.com. For everybody at the PRSA New Jersey chapter and at Professional Podcasts, I'm Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.